Comments made on the Serotalk Podcast Network are those of the individuals and do not represent Serotalk Corporation, its staff, management, board of directors, or third-party resellers.
Welcome to the Serotalk Podcast.
Welcome to the Serotalk Podcast, your portal to the accessible digital lifestyle.
www.serotalk.com,
a production of Serotech Corporation, makers of System Access, the System Access Mobile Network, and SA2Go. Learn about new technology, cool software, useful websites, education, information, entertainment, user comments, and much more. And now, here's your host, Jamie Pauls.
Welcome to Serotalk Podcast 87 for December 6th, 2011. I'm Jamie Pauls.
I'm Ricky Enger.
I'm Joe Steinkamp.
Our top story this week, are carriers responsible for mobile tracking software? Wow. Absolutely. This hit and has kind of been the talk of the internet for a while. You know, I guess maybe I'm one of those people that doesn't care enough about this sort of thing. I probably need to be a little more concerned than I am. Basically, the way I understand it is that Carrier IQ, as it's called, is mostly for diagnostics mode, and it doesn't keep track of things like passwords and all that good stuff. What have you taken away from this, Ricky?
Well, the thing is that this software can be made to get pretty much anything from your phone, including any sort of keystrokes or taps or whatever you want to call them. It could look at your web history, your text messages, and all this stuff. And of course, all of the carriers are saying, well, maybe it could, but no, we really don't do that. And it was kind of interesting because this was discovered to be on a lot of Android and Blackberries and even iPhones. But immediately everyone was saying, Nokia, no, we didn't put it on there. Blackberry, no, we didn't do it. Apple, no, we didn't do it. Well, we did sort of, but really it only tracks just this little bit of stuff, but we're going to take it out. Verizon has issued a statement saying that none of their phones have this software installed. And this appears to be a pretty U.S.-specific thing because things like Telstra, Vodafone, carriers
many
in the Netherlands.
EU carriers, and, yeah.
Yeah, they didn't have this problem at all. So this was something introduced by carriers, and it's something that they all claim is used specifically for diagnostic purposes, even though the software can be made to track every move you make, every breath you take, and all that stuff. They're saying, no, it really isn't. Apple was pretty cagey about this. I mean, they said they released a statement saying, this is on some devices, but not others. They weren't specific about which devices those were. And for the iPhone, at least, this is not necessarily the case with other phones. It's easy to turn this feature off. You can go to location services and then go to system settings, and there's a setting called diagnostic and usage or something like that. You can turn that off, and then this software is disabled on your phone. Apple has said that they intend to jerk it completely in an iOS 5 update, but we don't know when that's coming. I just feel like you can get as much up in arms or not about this as you want. I guess I'm a little like Jamie in that I probably don't care as much about this as I should. I kind of make the assumption that there is no privacy, and so when it actually happens, I'm not that surprised.
Right.
Yeah, what we heard already from Facebook this year with Mark, you know, if you're on the internet, then privacy is not something that you're caring that much about. I think it's important to take away here is that this isn't phone specific. There were a lot of,
oh, that's a typical Android thing, you know.
No, right.
It seemed to have no bounds, whether it be this platform, that platform, or others. And at some point, there has to be diagnostics in order to tell if the network is working correctly, if your phone is working correctly, if you have been hacked by something else. It brings phone security back into the light. You know, these are portable computers, for lack of a better situation to describe them as, and they can have malware. They can be hacked. They can be grabbed. They can be seen. And at the same time, they have to be able to talk back and forth to the network in order to give you geolocation. in order to give you, you know, things like Yelp and Foursquare and all that fun stuff. I mean, it's got
to
talk.
Yeah, I want to be able to check in on Foursquare, but I don't want anyone to know where I am.
Yeah, well, Foursquare knows, you know. It's, so there is an assumption here of privacy that is kind of askew, and there has to be some things in order for a carrier to provide you service correctly and timely and things like that. And, you know, years and years and years ago, it's like somebody hacking inside AOL. Well, AOL was not the internet. It was your network to the network of the internet. So of course they knew everything about you. And that's just how it works. If you really, really want to have a computing experience, then never connect to the internet. Stay offline. Take that machine and never, ever, ever do any updates online with ever having it talk to any other machines, then yes, that works. Of course, that's not the internet. So there's a lot to be said here. There's some things to be aware of. We've got a link here in the show notes to Tech News Today. They did a wonderful job of summarizing all of this, and they have some resources too, and some wonderful punditry on what is and is not realistic about this. So we're making you guys aware of it because it was like the big story of the week. But we also have some links here to read more about this so you can make your own decision on what is and isn't good about this particular issue.
So I guess Apple's had to do some multitasking this week because not only are they dealing with carrier IQ, but how about two smoking iPhones?
Two smoking iPhones. Wait, that's not part of the 12 Days of Christmas?
No, but it's an explosive story.
And it could be. It could be part of the 12 days, easily. The most recent one that we've heard about is Australia. It was a GSM phone. I don't really know which model it was, whether a 4 or 4S. But before that, there was one in Brazil that basically did a similar thing. Apparently, the incidents, the way they exploded or caught on fire, aren't exactly the same. So it may not be the same exact problem, although it seems pretty strange that it would happen two times, especially in light of the fact that, you know, Apple has been recalling some iPod Nanos for overheating, and some batteries have been replaced in times past for that same thing.
Yeah, so nobody knows really what's causing these things. Some people speculate that an iOS 5 update interacts with the hardware in a different way, and some people are just suspecting bad batteries. Nobody really knows, but hopefully we won't see too many more reports of this. They're trying to break it down and see exactly what happened. But, you know, if your phone is too hot to hold, you probably want to unplug it and run away.
Same thing with if it's in a case and you notice it's starting to get really hot. There have been some phone cases from Best Buy recalled that we also saw this week. And remember, like we've said before, when you make about 1 million or 5 million or 10 million of one object, you can have some, you know, bad ones every once in a while. And so this may be just a limited case, or it may be just a situation that a certain batch of phones made at a certain time have a problem. So I wouldn't get too freaked out about this, but if you do think your phone is kind of warm, I would maybe not stick it in the freezer or a bag of rice.
Do you guys think there's more scrutiny over iOS 5 than maybe other updates? And why do you think that is? You think it's because it's so in the news right now?
I think Apple is really in the news in general. And I recall there being scrutiny when iOS 4 was released. You had the update from 3.1 to 4. So it seems like there's always something going on where people sort of begin to tear down the OS and go, oh, this is wrong with it. That's wrong with it. You know, Apple is in a position where everything they do, whether it's positive or negative, is going to be pretty closely scrutinized, I think. You don't necessarily see this on things like Android because there are so many different versions of it. So not everybody is on the same thing. So things seem, at least to me, to be a little more spread out. You know, you don't have this huge outcry over one single version necessarily.
And to be fair, you have the same thing with some people who go,
I'm not going to upgrade Windows until the first service pack comes out.
The same thing goes for me. I don't want to go to Lion until I see one more 0.1 update. So, you know, for me, it was, you know, 10.6.5 3, you know, that's when I start to go, okay, they've got all the bugs worked out and it should be actually kind of stable now. So it's common for any type of major OS upgrade, any type of operating system upgrade to be a shakeout period. Like Ricky said, because it's just so prevalent right now, and because Apple tends to attract good and bad publicity, it's just a bigger microscope because it's a bigger stage now than ever before.
And no matter the size of Apple, when you go from a limited number of beta testers and engineers to multiplied millions of users, I mean, someone's going to flush out something, I would think, at some point.
Microsoft, too, where they release just Windows 7, for example, it was in beta for a while, and then it comes out, and all these people are like, how come all these bugs weren't caught in beta? Well, because, you know, now you're looking at a much larger sample of people.
One of the things that I'm looking forward to as a soon-to-be iPhone user, probably the end of this month, actually, is LookTel. And I heard about it, of course, when it came out and how excited people were. This is a money identification app for iOS devices. And when version 2.0 came out, apparently there was some regression. I don't know, Ricky, if you use it, or Joe, if you and you had seen that regression, but they released a new update that fixes a lot of that.
I did
apparently
see the regression, and I haven't gotten the update just yet. I will be doing that soon, and I suspect they've fixed quite a lot. In the 2.0 update, they added support for different types of currency, and I think maybe they just hadn't optimized scanning when they added those new types of currency, and they appear to have now done that, although I haven't tried it myself.
Right, I haven't seen any negative publicity, which I assume to be a good thing, actually.
Yeah, no news is good news.
Well, it's time to really get serious about buying Christmas presents for people, especially children. And according to our next article that you can find over in our show notes, iPad, iPhone, and iPod Touch are children's most wanted gifts. Well, imagine that. That's really not real surprising as far as I'm concerned.
Exactly. My son is actually getting an iPod Touch this year, not even so much because he begged for it or anything, but it makes a really nice gaming platform. There are a number of inexpensive children's games that you can get, from educational things like Moxie and Hangman, which he and I like to play together on my iPhone. But then you have the things like Plants vs. Zombies or Sonic the Hedgehog, and all of these things have, again, inexpensive apps that are considerably less expensive than, say, getting another handheld system like the Nintendo DS and buying the cartridges for that. So you have this very versatile handheld thing that does a lot more than gaming, and it just makes sense as a gift, and kids like it.
And while you're shopping, you can check out our next article, which are 10 must-have apps, awesome apps that you need for the holiday. Some of these are possibly accessible. A couple of them probably are not, but one I wish was. For example, Sparrow for Mac and Gmail. I haven't heard anything about that one way or the other.
Yeah, and I love the Mac Mail client anyway, so I'm probably not going to look at Sparrow just because I like where I am. There's 1Password, which is also accessible. There are a few things that probably aren't, like World of Goo, which is a puzzle game. It sounds interesting. The one that I really wanted to try was Scribble Knots, where you're sort of presented with something and you type in a word to get past it. Like if you saw a picture of a tree, you might type wings and your character grows wings, and so you're able to fly over the tree or whatever. I don't know if it's going to tell you what the picture is that you have to get past, though. Looks interesting, though.
I knew you would zero in on that one. I did, too. That instantly got my attention.
Yep.
There's a cookbook app. I don't know if that's accessible or not.
Yeah, that's the Professional Chef. That one's for the iPad.
Spotify, we've certainly heard about. Radio Mug, a music subscription service. Well, both of them are, actually. So definitely check those out. Our next article asks the question, is this the last Christmas for tax-free internet shopping? Brick-and-mortar stores are really feeling the heat, I guess you might say. And so It sounds like this is coming, probably. I mean, I suppose it's been inevitable for quite some time. Amazon complied with a California state sales tax, and I think we're just probably going to see that.
It's really unfortunate, too. I mean, I understand that retailers are being hurt in that a lot of people will go in and look at something, then they'll go find it online with free shipping and no internet tax, and they're good to go. But I wonder how they're going to do this, given that if your business is on the internet, then you can sell internationally. So how is that going to work? If you're in the U.S., then you pay taxes, and then what are people going to be doing, using anonymizers or whatever to appear that they're coming from an IP address outside the country? Oh, but we're shipping to an address in the U.S. You know, how does that work?
Well, you seem to be in Iowa, but yet your information traffic seems to be coming through Scandinavia.
It's a gift. I am shipping this overseas to my friend.
Yes, absolutely. Amazon is actually behind the national internet sales tax bill. So if anybody's kind of sort of figured it out, it's going to be Amazon and Walmart. We're going to see some of the bigger kind of places for this. And, you know, there was always talk of through many of the internet people who started this grand thing that we are using now, that this was the last untamed Wild West moment. And at some point, you know, the reality of the situation would catch up with everybody. And that's what we're seeing is more tech savvy people are getting into political office. And so they actually have a minor clue about how the internet works. It's not just a series of trucks and tubes. And
some
now
of
you're
them
starting.
May have invented the internet.
One or two. but now you're starting to see people kind of sort of go, you know, there is actually a way of doing this. It isn't completely an eight-armed octopus that we have to wrestle. And, you know, this is a moment where I used to work retail. And even back in the 90s, people would come in with their list because they were savvy shoppers and come in and say, okay, I'm thank you for showing me this. I'm now going home to buy it online where I can get it cheaper and free shipping and everything like that. So your store became more of a showroom. And that took a long time for other companies like Best Buy and some companies who are no longer with us to catch up with that. And we're starting to see that, of course, with books and other things and other stores shutting down. I think it's Best Buy in Europe right now that's closing because, you know, the internet is just too powerful and there are too many ways to make that happen. And at the end of the day, this is tax money that is falling away from the states who rely on gas tax, on retail tax, on sales tax in order to provide services for roads and schools and accessibility if you have states that have divisions or commissions for the blind. So in a long sort of roundabout way, this does affect you as an individual who relies on these services. So it's sad that this is happening, but it's kind of a necessary evil in one respect.
Well, we all know that you can spend a lot of money on electronic gadgets. We've all probably done it from time to time, but you can actually spend less than $50 and get some pretty good stuff. Ricky, what are some things that are listed in this article?
This is an article from CNET, and they have 10 gadgets here. The top gadget is a Roku, which has now dropped to $49. So that's a major competitor to Apple TV, although the accessibility of the Roku is pretty questionable. If you're buying this for somebody else, the Roku gets pretty good reviews. There's also a set of Kost Portapro headphones. Heard great things about those. And those can go with any of these MP3 players, which are listed here, including the iPod Shuffle, the Sansa Clip, which I believe you can put Rockbox on if you want that to be accessible. And then they have things like USB drives and the like. So there are definitely some pretty good choices for getting your favorite techie person something and still having some money to spend on your own gadgets.
And along those same lines, just having wrapped up Thanksgiving and eaten too much turkey as usual, we're kind of still in the thankful mood and the thankful vein. We have 50 free apps that we're most thankful for. I was pleased to see how many of those I actually use or at least am familiar with. Number one on the list is Dropbox. I think we all pretty much use that. Google Chrome is something that is becoming more accessible. Still a ways to go on that, but definitely some progress. Many people use Firefox.
Skype is on the list, and Evernote is also on the list. I've heard mixed accessibility reviews for Evernote. I think that they have at least been contacted and are working on improving the experience.
Sounds great. Yeah, we'll definitely keep an eye on that. Gmail, 7-Zip, TeamViewer. I'm not familiar with that one. It's a remote desktop management program.
Yeah, it is not accessible. It's the equivalent of using something like a remote incident manager. Plug here. But again, it's inaccessible to us, but it allows you to jump onto somebody's machine and do technical support because you're seeing what's on their machine and you can fix what's wrong with it. A lot of help desks use this. Again, if you're looking for an accessible alternative, you can check out Saratech's Remote Incident Manager, which will allow you to do this. And it doesn't matter which screen reader the person is using or whether they have one on their machine at all.
How about number 14, Google Reader? Is there any accessibility there at all?
I haven't done a lot of playing with Google Reader, but there are several other Google offerings on this list, like Google Docs, which is improving in its accessibility, but not quite there. There's Google Calendar, which I do use some.
Number 17 on the list is CCleaner. We're all pretty familiar with that. WordPress, many of us are also very familiar with that, as well as FileZilla.
Yes, good old FileZilla, one of the best FTP clients I have used, and it's free, so yay.
One I'm not familiar with, is it KeepPass, Password Manager?
Yeah, I've never tried this either. There are several on this list that I'm not familiar with, but given that there are 50 apps, you can spend quite a bit of time looking at this. Again, these are all free, and some of them may be accessible and some of them may not be, but you have very little to lose by trying some of these out.
So go over to our show notes page and check out this article and, as Ricky said, give several of these apps a try and report back to us. Let us know what you find. Well, those barcode thingies that we come across all the time, there is actually something new called QR codes, which the way I understand it is kind of maybe an enhanced barcode, but they can be on lots of different things like menus even.
Yeah, and I think Joe was talking about this two or three podcasts ago and the idea that some of these things actually show up on your TV. So you can point your phone with a camera in it and snap a picture of this thing. And you can get pretty creative with what these codes are able to do. For example, the one thing they mentioned in the article was you might be at a concert and one of the band members has a QR code on his shirt. You snap this picture and then you either go online on your computer and upload the image, or there are actually some apps that you can install on your phone that will allow you to look up what this QR code is for, and then maybe it provides free stuff. Maybe it gives you a restaurant menu on your phone that you can look at whenever you want. So there are a lot of things that you can do with this.
So I've seen two other examples of this recently. My mom is a big cruise line kind of person, so she's gone on like Norwegian and Carnival. She got a postcard in the mail, and all it really had was a QR code on it. And it was weird because you take your phone, you take a picture of it, and then you get the full ad experience. And it's cheaper, of course, to send a postcard rather than, a bulk mailer of pictures and all of this of what you're trying to sell somebody on. And another one that I ran into is a local fast food chain in this area put QR codes on their burger wrappers. And so you could take a picture of it and then find out more about what you were eating, calories. There was a coupon, so if you printed it out, you could actually come back to this chain and get another burger. And it was just really interesting. So Japan, like I said in a previous podcast, is very big on QR codes. They're on a lot of things. And it's something that, you know, going forward is kind of neat accessibility-wise, because in a lot of cases, they link to websites that we can then read with a screen reader, or they link to video or audio ads that you can then get. Some even link to downloading free MP3s, like go to this site and it's a page and you can have a single, like Ricky was talking about, from the band members that are having it.
You can definitely get really creative with this. I was kind of laughing when you mentioned that they had this on the burger wrapper, because I was imagining you taking this picture of the QR code and you go and it gives you the food information. This burger is 1,800 calories, and print out this coupon code for $50 off at the heart surgeon.
So what does it look like visually? I mean, is it, are there instructions on it that say, point your phone at this and take a picture?
It looks a lot like a barcode, but it can have little squiggles or different types of information on it. And you know it means something, because it looks very much like a UPC code, but it means something completely different in ones and zeros to computers and apps that are looking for that. And we've talked about like Red Laser and other applications that can kind of do that and then, you know, have a conversation with the internet in order to get that information back and forth. You can store certain bits of information. In a way, this is what people thought RFID tags were going to be. Remember when you would have an RFID tag reader and you would walk up to it and then your device would ping the tag that's on, let's say, a box of Kleenex, and then it would tell you everything about that? Well, you can do this without having to have two things talking back and forth like with RFID tags. Plus, you can rewrite the information on an RFID tag, whereas a QR code is already printed on there, and it's a little bit more difficult to mess up or harder to alter.
We talked earlier about brick-and-mortar stores feeling some pressure from online sales. We have another article, Friday Cyber Monday Euphoria, Clicks Cannibalize Bricks. And this article says exactly what you said, Joe, that people go to the store, inspect an item, go home, and buy it online. So I totally get what you're saying about stores just being showrooms. And that's really unfortunate. That's a real serious problem for them.
And that's why you see Microsoft have a store, Apple have a store. All these other retailers are having to involve, like Best Buy has an Apple section. And in some cases, Apple actually has a store within a store concept. And you see that in other ways too. Like there's a McDonald's inside a Walmart or Radio Shack inside this other store. And it's to get, you know, part of that back where people are searching on the internet. And if you, again, can walk up to a product in a store, take a picture of it, go to a website, and it'll tell you 15 other places where in that store you're at where you can get it cheaper, it makes it very difficult for the retailer. And so what do you do in a situation like that? Well, you sell service. Or when you purchase from an online retailer, you might not have the customer service experience you might have with a small business in your area or a local business in your area. You know, you form relationships, partnerships, and trust, where online you might not necessarily have that same feeling unless you're feel comfortable about Amazon, you feel comfortable about Google, or you feel comfortable in other ways. And there was an article actually earlier this week I had read about how more people are partnering up with Amazon, like Target. So, you know, people might not search Google to find the best deal. They might just go straight to Amazon, and Amazon would have Target as a partner. So Amazon still is sort of getting a little bit of a piece, but Target's getting the brand recognition of Amazon to ride on coattails in order to get you to buy from Target. It's a really interesting time, and technology gives you a lot more ability to find out more about a product, reviews, prices, and alternate ways of purchasing than ever before. And for some people, maybe they purchase through Amazon because they have Prime and they get the free 2-day shipping. That's why Google this week was talking about possibly buying into a shipping company. So when you would go to do a product search on Google, you would find other partners that would ship it to you through this Google shipping, you know, thing to be able to go after Amazon Prime. These are all ways of saving money, but they're also all ways of thinking of your, you know, gigantic web services as your main portal. You see that with a Kindle Fire. You know, if you stay within the Amazon ecosystem and you get a Fire, well, then all your MP3s are there and you have access to video and movies. Oh, and you might buy a book about the movie you just watched, or vice versa. So there's a lot of stuff involved here where these larger individuals, Facebook is in there too, want to be the place you go to for all your information. And of course, all that information is great for advertisers. So one hand washes the other. And it's really interesting because if you're a mom and pop organization, you've got to find ways to make yourself marketable in that situation. The advantage is that the mom and pop is right there in your neighborhood and you know them and you might go to school with them or you might go to the same church with them or you might run into them at the grocery store. So it's an interesting time. And having worked retail, I can say honestly, I don't know what I would do if I was back in that situation now because there's a lot of voices and very large voices can drown out the small business voices. And that's why Saturday, it was the first time I ever heard it. Friday was Black Friday, of course, but Saturday was Small Business Saturday. And American Express was sponsoring Facebook pages for small businesses to get people to go out and see these other businesses in their area. Like in Houston, there's the Rice Village area, which has a lot of specialty shops that you wouldn't necessarily find some things on the internet that are, you know, easy to look for, but you may just discover them. And we have this in music too. You know, Spotify and SiriusXM and all that. How do you discover what you want to buy? It's either through your friends or through a discovery service. So the nature of purchase is different. And that's why places like Spotify make the record store obsolete, unfortunately. That's a shame too, because I have many happy memories of just walking through record stores and rolling through the vinyl or the used CD section or what have you.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting because I know what you're saying about going to a record store and browsing. For someone who is totally blind, obviously the digital age, you know, has made music much more accessible than ever before. But yeah, I can remember, you know, rifling through vinyl albums that some listeners probably don't even have firsthand knowledge of what those actually are anymore.
Yeah,
totally. In technology news, more technology news, I guess. Amazon releases the Kindle source code. I found this interesting and wonder how this might affect accessibility of Kindle.
I have mixed feelings about that because on one hand, I'm pragmatic enough to say, you know, whoever builds accessibility, I'm just glad it's there and maybe I'll get the device. I don't particularly want one, even if it were accessible, but I would like it if the choice were there. And I might say, again, on one hand, good, somebody did it, so now it's available. On the other hand, I feel a little strange about this because somebody else comes along and does what Amazon should have done in the first place, and then Amazon can just snap it up and say, oh, hey, thanks for doing our work. Now we're going to incorporate it in future releases, and you kind of get nothing for putting in all this hard work.
Apple, Instapaper, that never happens.
No, that never happens. Nobody ever snaps up the work of small developers and claims it as their own. But the article does say that Amazon has very, very heavily modified the stock Android source code to put on the Kindle Fire. So in some cases, it was practically unrecognizable as Android. So from that, I get that there may actually be a little work involved if somebody wanted to build some accessibility in here, because you're not only looking at stock Android and the accessibility features or lack thereof, you know, that were in Gingerbread, but you're also looking at whatever Amazon modified and whether there's any way to get at that stuff and make it accessible.
It's not the only, Amazon's not the only company doing this. There are five variants of Android going on in China. And, you know, there's an
accessibility
nightmare there.
Everybody's modifying it.
Exactly. So there's the issue is, you know, even if, let's say, hypothetically, Google and Android had some built-in accessibility, when you modify it, you know, it's very possible that somebody could go, you know, I just need to save some kernel space. We'll just wipe that accessibility part out right there too. Because,
yeah,
you know, who's ever going to use that? I mean, blind people use, you know, devices, whatever. And, you know, that's the danger thereof too, is that, yes, it's open source and yes, people can do what they want with it. But then you know, if one becomes dominant, if a variant becomes dominant, let's say the Kindle OS becomes dominant, then you're locked out and we're having to start the argument all over again about, hey, accessibility needs to be there. That's not the case right now, of course, in that we don't have the Kindle being a dominant player, but in the future it could be. It could challenge the iPad, and it could be something that we need to keep an eye on. And then again, 5 years ago, it was the BlackBerry. And now
well,
it's
and not so much.
Yeah, definitely not.
But Amazon would have you believe that the Kindle Fire is an iPad killer. I mean, it supposedly has jumped to number two in sales for tablets. So I think it's a real possibility that it's going to be a major player. Now, it depends on how much Amazon is padding things and how much publicity is real and how much of it isn't. But I think that Kindle OS or whatever you want to call it will be a force to be reckoned with.
Jamie?
Yes, I'm still here.
Okay. I need
He's
you.
Like,
I need,
yeah, what you said.
Uh-huh. I need you to put on your referee shirt and your black and white stripes and okay. Either blow the whistle on this or side one way or the other. What do you think?
You know, I really actually am with Ricky. Well, first of all, I also do not plan to buy a Kindle Fire. Never really have if it was accessible. I would also be pleased if someone would make it accessible, but I also think that Amazon needs to step up to the plate and do the right thing here. And I think that is to make their products accessible to the blind from the ground up. So
Perfect summation.
How I feel. Thank you.
Perfect summation. How do you all feel?
And nobody had to punch anybody.
No,
that's right.
Let us know how you guys feel. Leave us an iReport. Write us at resources@sarotalk.com. You know, all the normal channels on Twitter and our page at sarotalk.com. Let us know what you guys think, too, on this situation, because we've had our say. Now we're interested in what you think about the Kindle Fire.
This next article would have interested me a lot more just a few years ago, just a couple years back. I was a T-Mobile customer, really liked the service, thought the customer service was great. Unfortunately, where I live, I was right on the edge of coverage. I mean, just on the ragged edge. So the idea that AT&T might acquire T-Mobile would have been fascinating to me because AT&T has a lot better coverage in this area. But it really looks like that's not going to happen. The application with the FCC has been removed. A lot of opposition from the Department of Justice and from Sprint, among other carriers. So apparently this isn't going to happen, but yet the article says, you know, that it's not completely out of the question.
Yeah, basically the two carriers are still saying, yeah, it's really going to happen. We're still committed to this deal, but I think the writing's on the wall and this is not going to go through. I suspect the saga to continue for quite a while, but I think the end result is going to be this isn't going to happen.
I agree. So Facebook just made a major deal with the government. I actually kind of, I didn't know whether to laugh or feel sorry for Facebook when I read this article. They have agreed to, yeah, we're going to protect user privacy. We're not going to, you know, give out their information anymore without telling them that we're going to do that. And okay, we will seek a third-party audit every so often to make sure that we're actually abiding by the rules that we just agreed to. It's kind of embarrassing, I think.
The deal that they made does require them to submit at random intervals to this sort of audit from a third-party entity over the next 20 years. And the part of the article that I really loved was the statement, I think, from Mark Zuckerberg. I don't remember seeing his name, but I'm assuming it was from some Facebook representative saying, I think we've done a fantastic job of managing user privacy, and I think we've made a lot of mistakes in managing user privacy, but I think we're the best at managing user privacy. So it was
yes. A
little embarrassing to read that, just watching how many contradictions happened within about three sentences. But yes,
it's
Facebook.
Like Netflix.
Oh, no. I have a feeling that's going to become a term that is used in common parlance from now on. Uh-oh, you just pulled a Netflix.
Yeah.
That's got to be sad.
I guess it's better than pulling a rim because, you know, that's much worse. Mark Zuckerberg has a 1,200 or 1,400 word article out about how they got here and where it started. He says it happens to be where Beacon came aboard in 2009, and that was the giving the advertisers more information about you than they should have had kind of thing. And he goes on to explain about where things have faltered and where they've gone. But, you know, to be honest with you, it's the multiple changes really that kind of freak me out is there's no version number of Facebook. Facebook just does what Facebook does, and you don't know it until you log in and go, oh, what happened to Facebook today? Oh, that's interesting.
And it doesn't always do it across all accounts at the same time either.
Right. True. They roll things out in waves, so 1% of their users may see something that the other 99% don't. So that means out of 750 million people, only a handful of people get to see what's going on or an update. Like the new user changes with the ticker bar and stuff like that. My wife got those before anybody else I knew had it. And so I got to hear for 3 weeks before they were released how awful they were, because she told me every time she logged into Facebook.
Even though Facebook is going to be required now to make a major effort to notify users that privacy changes are happening, we're still going to have the issue of, you know, yeah, click agree. And then people are coming back and saying, what did I just agree to? But at the very least, Facebook will have done their part to notify users. And at that point, it's up to the users themselves as to whether they actually pay attention or not.
Absolutely. They could do an email to you. They could have a page, you know, specifying what they've done. They could have it posted as a press release. They could have it pop up on your screen as something you have to click on in order to get past it to start using Facebook. And people will still say, well, I didn't know that such and such and so happened. What do you mean? And, you know, there does become a situation where if you're using a service, you have to keep up with the service in order to know what that service is doing or why it's doing it. And Facebook, like other companies, is just growing. This happens all the time to larger companies. Microsoft can tell you about that with unbundling Internet Explorer in Europe all the time. You know, this is a sign of a company getting bigger and becoming a much better Internet citizen. You know, speaking of Microsoft, we have an article here that I'll show you how to get the new Microsoft Security Essentials. That's been updated with a public beta. So speaking of change, there's one coming. So far, it seems to be not harsh accessibility-wise. We've done some testing internally. It kind of has sort of the same feel as Microsoft Security Essentials in the past. But if you want to check that out and see what it's going to look like, you can get the public beta by going over to the show notes.
Coming up after the break, news and assistive technology and the mailbag here on the Serotalk Weekly Podcast.
My name is Ruth Roosey. I'm a retired teacher. I'm 91 years old, and this is how I live United. I say retired, but not really. Once a week, I read books to children as part of United Way's education program. Reading to a child creates links between language and literacy. It creates a bond between grown-up and child. And believe it or not, it prepares them for a better academic future. Oh, we read about frogs and flies and pigs with wings, all sorts of juicy stuff. It's a joy to watch all those little faces. I figure I have the time and they have the need. And I've always believed that if we're not here to help each other, then what are we here for, really? My name is Ruth Roosey. I help kids prepare to succeed in school. So I don't just wear the shirt, I live it.
Give, advocate, volunteer, live United. Go to liveunited.org, brought to you by United Way and the Ad Council.
We're back here on the Serotalk podcast, and in assistive technology news, WindowEyes 7.5.2 has been released. I am a WindowEyes user, and a lot of stability fixes. They are continuing to do that on the road to browse mode overhaul in version 8.0. That's, you know, one of those things that we'd love for it to be a quick process, but it isn't, and we know it isn't, and that's just one of those things. But definitely I've seen some good posts on the list from users who seem to be happy with 7.5.2. Also, NVDA 2011.3, I love how they number these releases, has been released. I have not had a chance to play with that yet. I have downloaded it, but haven't had a look at it.
Yeah, I haven't either, but I've heard some very good things about it. Also released this week is a new enhanced firmware for the Milestone 2.12 and 3.12. You can actually apparently play videos on this thing now. There isn't a screen on the device, but it will do something such that you can hear the audio in whatever videos that you load on it. You can play music from your iTunes library and all sorts of other happy stuff. So if you've got a milestone, you'll definitely want to check this out. Also, in terms of book players, the BookSense Master is coming soon. Now, this is, I guess, just for my own curiosity. I recall at one point there was a BookSense Buddy. Was that a piece of software that was done by GW Micro? And now
yes, it was.
The BookSense Master is a HIMS specific version of this.
Yeah, that is right.
Gotcha.
That sounds right. So I didn't use either one, and honestly, I chose a BookSense because I didn't have to use software to load things like this. So I can understand that some people do like software of this kind, but man, I just like dragging and dropping onto a book player. It was one of the reasons why I bought a BookSense.
Yeah, I hear you. I'm one of these lazy people. I actually like the HumanWare Companion for my Victor reader stream because I don't have to go through the arduous process of unzipping the file. Man, is that ever difficult? Except it's not. But I just prefer seeing all my books in a list, checking the one I want to transfer, and having it go unzip it and put it on the card.
You know what I also like?
What?
I love hooking up a Victor Reader Stream or BookSense to System Access Mobile Network or DocuScan Plus and dropping files directly onto it. It's seamless
Isn't
and easy.
That nice. Yes, it is.
Yeah. It just works.
Yay there for self-promotion.
Well, Joe, we talked about Zoom Text 10 a little bit, maybe last podcast or the one before, and it's out now. Can you tell us a little more about that this time?
AI Squared has released the latest version of Zoom Text, and they have also recommended a camera that will work with their OCR feature. That's kind of neat. There is going to be also the ability to use it kind of like a video magnifier as well. So there's the camera feature and some other features that are in the tools menu of Zoom Text. Now, I've got some videos up that they've got to demonstrate what some of these features are going to do. Internet Explorer 9 support is better. I really like the way ZT10 is working in Firefox. I've been using Firefox on Twitter and ZT reading that. That's actually been neat with App Reader. So there's some features in here that are compelling if you're already a Zoom Text user. And certainly it's been a while since there's been a paid upgrade. So I totally go with the idea of upgrading here. Because you're getting some interesting things like background reader. So you can actually have Zoom Text reading in the background while visually you're clicking on other things, which is awesome for proofreading and that kind of thing. So their manuals are online, and a lot of the feature product stuff is being featured on their blog. If you want to know more about it, just head on over to AI Squared, that's SQUARED.com. So check that out if you're interested in the latest from that company.
Well, the Braille monitor is now on NFB Newsline. And I mean, honestly, I'm kind of curious as to why it took so long. I would have thought that would have been something that happened almost immediately.
Agreed. But lots of people are excited that it has finally come to pass.
A really interesting article. This is one of those why didn't we think of this sooner moments. A new method for solving CAPTCHAs is in the works. And it involves, of all things, sounds. So, for example, you might be ready to solve a CAPTCHA and you might hear a babbling brook, and you have to identify that sound. You know, that is because sighted people have as much trouble with CAPTCHAs, well, not as much as blind people, but they definitely have their share. And this seems to be a way of perhaps solving CAPTCHAs.
Yeah, I still have some concerns about this because it doesn't do anything to address the deafblind population. And without getting too high up on a soapbox, I don't want us to get into a situation where the blind population, which is significantly larger than the deafblind population, we say, all right, we got what we wanted. And then there's this group of deafblind users who are still locked out, and they inquire of companies, are you going to do anything to fix this for us? And companies are like, what do you people want now? We already implemented this thing. So You know, CAPTCHA is just one of those things where there aren't any easy answers, but I'm glad to know that people are actually thinking about it.
And that's an excellent point, and I'm glad you brought it up, because I was guilty of doing just what you said. I mean, it sounds good to me. I am pleased with the possibility, and I wasn't thinking of people who might not benefit. So I'm glad that you brought that up.
It happens a lot when some people look at accessibility from what access means to you, and that makes lots of sense because it's the way that you access the internet. But you have to sometimes take yourself out of the equation and think about what others have to do, what deaf individuals have to do in order to, you know, be a part of things like podcasts. If there's not a transcript of the podcast, like this very podcast, then deaf individuals can't necessarily take part in a medium that we enjoy and love. The same way that, you know, you have to think of accessibility for those who are physically handicapped using switches or other types of things like eye tracking or head movement, or there are individuals who use trackballs instead of using a mouse. So I always kind of cringe when I see somebody use a blanket term like,
it's accessible.
Well, accessible for the blind, or accessible for low vision, or accessible for this. And I try to do that when I'm talking on Twitter as best I can. I post a lot of mainstream stuff, and I do have to sometimes go back and say, look, I'm presenting this because it's information we all should know about. We can't just stay in one side of the pool. We have to go swim on all sides of the pool, the deep end, the shallow end, and jump off the high dive. And we have to be out there advocating.
And that's just it. I don't think you could get three people in a room, even if they had the same disability, to agree on what accessibility is. And then you look at, okay, we should think of others besides ourselves and what they need. But the truth is that we can't be experts. We would probably be just as guilty of making assumptions about what accessibility means to another group as, you know, we've faced ourselves from time to time. So I guess where I'm going with this is I would like for there to be a lot more communication between various disability groups and between, you know, mainstream technologists as well, so that the experts in a particular branch of accessibility get a chance to speak about what it is that they need, and we stop assuming what's going to work for everyone based on our own experiences.
You know what communication we need?
What?
We need communication about the end of the year. You know, we're coming up on the end of 2011, and we're starting to look back at what this year has been in assistive technology. On Seraspectives, we host once a month a This Month in AT, and we've started to put all of those 11 months together into what we think we need to cover for this year on AT. And we're looking to you, fellow listener, to tell us what the big stories were in 2011. So if you can let us know in an iReport or send us an email letting us know by what are the big stories, or what was your favorite Serotalk moment? Was it a robot guide dog? Was it Ricky traveling into an echo chamber? Was it many of other things that we've talked about here on the show? Let us know, because we want to be able to feature that in what we covered in this year in assistive technology. As well as, we have a new episode of That Android Show up. JJ and Anna and I have a wonderful conversation with the gentleman behind At Seeing with Sound. And it's a wonderful conversation about what perception is. And then Anna demonstrates audio perception with an Android app that allows her to hear a tiled floor, hear a row of books. And to hear what I'm saying about that, you should go listen to That Android Show, which is available at thatandroidshow.com, or follow us on Twitter at @thatandroidshow.
We love to hear your comments. You can send email to resources@serotalk.com. You can call 866-997-DLAB 2522. And certainly on Twitter, the different podcasts have their own Twitter feeds. You can check those out. Speaking of mail, we have some this week. We had a lot of feedback about Podcast 85's robot guide dog story. Who knew that would get so much attention? People loved it. And Beth writes, and she points out a really great reason for possibly needing a robot guide dog. there are some people who have sensitivity to animals. Beth, I had not even considered that. That is a great possible reason to have a robot guide dog. We also have an email from Tyler. And Tyler checked out the Type in Braille app that we talked about as well. And, you know, Ricky and I had some real concerns, I guess, about how easy this thing would be to use. It looked really difficult to use when we were reading about it. But Tyler says he actually downloaded it and had a look at it. And he says it's not bad at all. He kind of enjoys it. James Mannion is frustrated with iOS issues that he says impact some people and not others. And he really kind of thinks that this battery issue has been around for a while. And he submitted feedback to Apple at apple.com/feedback. And he really kind of encourages all of us to do the same thing.
I think we talked about this a bit earlier in the show about how much scrutiny each new iOS update gets. And this does seem to happen a lot where people jump from 3.1 to 4 and suddenly battery life is horrible, whereas it wasn't before. And then a fix is released and some people are happy and some people aren't. So I think he's right in that, at least to some degree, Apple has been fixing things and then introducing problems to others who previously didn't have an issue. That may happen across more phones than just Apple, but Apple seems to get a lot of attention for it.
David M. Leposky has also sent us some email, and he is concerned that the accessibility page for doing Google searches at google.com is gone. And I've never checked that out, actually, to, you know, to see if that was, if it really is gone or if that was just something that maybe happened for a short time. I tend to just use the regular site. Travis Peterson of Columbia, Illinois, tells us about captionfish.com. That's a site that helps the deaf community find closed caption movies. But along with that, you can find show listings for some DVS movies if they're described in your area. It also has an accessible iOS app that you can check out. So thank you for that. And thanks for all of those emails. Great feedback this time.
Yes, we love your emails. We love your voicemails. We love it when you tell us that we've made a mistake and need to be corrected. And we also love it when you just write in and tell us about some things that we didn't know about. So again, provide that feedback, resources@serotalk.com, or through an iReport on iBlink Radio, or you can catch us via Twitter.
In our final segment that we're now calling Roundabout, Disney Web Accessibility, there's a lawsuit that has been filed, and it's being settled out of court. Three women from the states of California and Kansas filed a suit because it's not possible to make reservations and download tickets electronically. There aren't a lot of details about the settlement right now. Apparently, some details will be coming later. But there were kind of some mixed feelings about this. There were some people that really wanted the publicity out there about the need for accessibility, and for this major company to be in court discussing this would have definitely garnered a lot of publicity. But it appears that that's not to be, at least at this time. Handwriting communication system could let the visually impaired feel their messages. When I read this, I was thinking, you know, like tactile drawings or something, but this is on the palm of the hand. Not quite sure how I feel about that. I mean, and it's Braille messages. Again, I was thinking print, but apparently these would be like Braille dots on the palm of your hand. I don't know.
Talk about a solution looking for a problem. The original intent of the thing was that it would be a mainstream device where a sighted person could do handwriting on one device and the other person would have this device where the letters come across in the palm of their hand. And the intent was to somehow, don't ask me how, but to transmit the emotion that was being felt when the message was composed. So, you know, I guess if the thing is feels like a joy buzzer where it's vibrating your hand off or something, the person was really angry. And then if it feels all tickly, then the person's trying to be funny. I don't quite get it. But
no.
The article was then talking about, okay, we can make this something more practical so that somebody's handwriting on some device and then the Braille letters will show up on the palm of a person's hand. All right, well.
So if I wrote, "I hate you" in Braille, would that really hurt?
I think it should. I mean, if the emotion is coming across along with the message, yeah, you should be developing blisters on your hands in the shape of those dots. Very bizarre. But hey, who knows what this kind of thing could be actually used for in a practical way.
It kind of makes me think of Harry Potter. Wasn't there the mean teacher that made him write something over and over?
Yes.
Yeah.
And he began to feel it.
Yes.
Ouch.
Emotional Braille. Emoticon Braille.
Emotional Braille.
Emoticon
like
through emotional Braille.
There you go.
Only communicate with your friends.
That's right.
Well, finally on this week's show, a new cane for the blind uses Foursquare check-ins to locate nearby friends. This was pretty interesting. There's a video that goes with this, and if I understand this right, a lot of the mechanics of the device are in the handle of the cane. It didn't sound like it was a really heavy cane, although it's kind of hard to tell as you're listening, but you have to wonder, what's the heft of this thing?
Yeah, you got to wonder about the ergonomics of the thing, because there is a phone embedded in the handle of the cane, and you'd think that would get kind of uncomfortable to grip, but the phone is... It's a smartphone. It doesn't say what brand of smartphone it is. And it also has this interesting arrow pointing device of sorts that will change direction depending on which direction you're supposed to go to get to your final destination. It does connect with a Bluetooth earpiece, and you can do Foursquare check-ins and then be alerted if some of your friends who are on Foursquare are nearby and actually get directions on walking right to them.
With the vibrating shoes, that would be great. If it could Bluetooth to the vibrating
shoes.
Oh
yeah, you could pair the vibrating shoes with this. Mm-hmm. You could be wearing the Kinect helmet and have the laptop taped to you also.
Absolutely. And the robot guide dog with your extra power pack in case you need to charge all that at one point. Then
along with
rains,
the vibrating glasses.
Exactly. Oh, I forgot about the vibrating glasses. Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
And then when it rains, you are a lightning magnet.
Sweet.
Absolutely.
And there is emoticon Braille in your hand as you're walking.
Right. Exactly. Right. Okay. With the glove. Right. You could do the power glove on one hand and then vibrating Braille on the other hand, and then you can try and walk through TSA and explain it all when you're going home for the holidays.
We are the blind board. You will be assimilated.
And people would be staring, saying, look at this bizarre person, coming down the road.
Resistance is futile.
That's right.
That sounds horrible. I would hate to charge all those batteries. I mean, maybe there is something to having the iPhone do everything at once. How's that? Maybe this is where I submit.
No, but you get a good workout. You don't even have to go to the gym.
That's true. Wow. Let us know what you think, what devices you think would help. I mean, there's always something about augmented reality or alternative input methods, but has this gone too far?
Yes. Which devices would you use and which would you jettison? Which would you get rid of? Well, that's going to do it for this week's edition of the Serotalk podcast. We've a couple of times given you information about how to get a hold of us, and at the end of the show, you're going to hear that again. I will tell you to go on over to serotalk.com. Check out the show notes, read the articles, take a look at everything that we've got there. Also, go over to iTunes, especially if you subscribe over there to the podcast, and rate us. That would really be helpful. We would appreciate that a lot. Trust that you all are having a great week. And until next time, take care.
Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Serotalk. Visit us at www.serotalk.com. Send us an email at resources@serotalk.com. Send us an iReport with iBlink Radio, available in the Apple App Store and the Android Market. Or leave a voicemail at 866-997-BLAB. That's 2522. We may read your email or play your voicemail in the next podcast. Join us next week as we explore all that life and the internet have to offer. Until then, may you have an accessible digital life. We'll be right back.